Now I'll ask our brother John to come forward, and tonight what we'll be looking at is Sennacherib coming up against King Hezekiah.
Thank you, Mark, and good evening, brethren and sisters, young people. Just before we get underway tonight, I'd just like to mention that it was very pleasing last night at the seminar, singular, we had 15 friends there, and none of those had been before. I mean, on one hand, that's not good. We would like to see people that have been before. But on the other hand, they were completely new. So there's 15 new people who live in the area that obviously have received invites from time to time. But on this occasion, they decided to come. And it's pretty obvious that the Stamford Grand does certainly pull people in. We have never, ever put on something in that centre without having outstanding attendance. So it was a terrific night to have 15 friends there, and many of whom said they were coming again. We even finished, for those who are speakers in our midst, at 5 to 9, which was 5 minutes early, so that's pretty good. Not that I was speaking, but the two speakers did finish early at 5 to 9, and that even allowed for some supper. So quite a good performance all round. And it reminded me of the contrast we have with another gentleman that's in town, a Bishop Spong from the USA. And Bishop Spong, who is an Anglican, or they don't call them Anglicans in the USA, they call them another name, which is very hard to pronounce. So we'll just call him an Anglican. And his philosophy is basically to cast doubt on what the Bible has to say. So on one hand, we have a bishop of the Anglican faith in town telling people that a lot of the Bible is unreliable, and at the same time at the Stamford Grand we have 15 people who are interested in learning to read the Bible effectively. What a greater contrast you could get. Now tonight is the first of six evenings on Isaiah 36 through to Isaiah 39, end of chapter 39, and it is dealing entirely with the time of Hezekiah. Now, I understand at the last young people's suburban class, Hezekiah was dealt with, so the young people would be right up with many aspects of Hezekiah. And quite a bit of the background to the events leading up to this section here in Isaiah has been dealt with in our class. For example, the issue in Isaiah 36 through to 38 is the confrontation essentially between Hezekiah and the Assyrian, and in particular Sennacherib. And you may recall over the many months that we've been studying Isaiah that we have looked at a number of chapters where the Assyrian is mentioned. Now we're not going to turn these up, but you may recall, for example, such notable chapters as Isaiah chapter 10, Isaiah 30, Isaiah 31, Isaiah 33. They are probably the most significant chapters that deal with the Assyrian, and perhaps 31 and 33 more so than chapter 30. And so we've got a bit of a background to the character of the Assyrian. It's interesting, isn't it, that we finished the class when we dealt with Isaiah last in chapter 35. You may recall, of course, that chapter 35 is a very outstanding chapter which speaks all about the kingdom, the time of blessing and peace that shall cover the earth. And then we turn the page and as it were, we're brought right back to earth. After being exalted and lifted up, considering the kingdom in chapter 35, suddenly we are brought back to reality, to what life is all about. And in the providence of God, it's obviously designed that way. It's a bit like Revelation in a way, isn't it? Where in the Apocalypse we are given historical chapters, then we have a vision of the kingdom, in the various symbols. And then after being given our vision of the kingdom, we're then taken back and we have the continuous historical narrative presented. And so I think it's similar here. We are lifted up and exalted when we consider the kingdom aspect in chapter 35. And having been brought to that wonderful position, Isaiah then brings his listeners and his readers back to reality to consider what life is all about. And life is a matter of dealing with day-to-day issues and how we react to those issues that come upon us. And that's what we're going to do over the next few classes. We're going to see how that the issues that confronted Hezekiah and the nation very much affect us as well. Many of us know a lot about Hezekiah, but I've got a few overheads here which I think will help us just to get the picture. Now, you know his name means the strength of Yahweh. And just going to briefly now recapitulate aspects of Hezekiah's life, because I think it's very important to do this. Rather than just sort of leaping straight into chapter 36 and dealing with this man Hezekiah, we've got to understand the background to the circumstances in Isaiah 36. Okay, he commenced at the age of 25. He reigned for 29 years. And he was a very faithful king, a man of great action. He was always into it as soon as he could. And so in the first month of his reign, he opened the doors of the temple and prepared the temple for use. You may recall, of course, that the temple had lapsed into misuse through the work of his father, Ahaz. And Hezekiah in 16 days did more than his father had done in 16 years. The next notable thing that Hezekiah did was that he reinstated the Passover, which had been neglected for many years. And a feature of Hezekiah's reign was that he extended invitations to all the people of the kingdom, not just to his own dominion in Judah. He extended invitations right up north into Israel. And a summary of that time was given in 2 Chronicles 30:26. So there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there was not the like in Jerusalem. He was an outstanding king who did everything he could to elevate the minds of the people. Now, after celebrating that wonderful Passover, Hezekiah then set about cleansing the land of idolatry. And once again, he didn't just focus his attention in the south. He sent his men into the northern kingdom, into Ephraim, and there also cleared the land of the objects of false worship. He then reinstituted the tithes by which the Levites could be supported. Now, because the tithes, as commanded under the law, had been also neglected, it meant, therefore, that the Levites weren't properly supported. And if the Levites had to fend for themselves, then it meant they had less time to spend teaching the people God's law. So Hezekiah considered it very important to support the Levites in everyday material things so that they would have more time to devote to the study of God's law and to teach the people. He refused to pay tribute money imposed during the reign of Ahaz. Ahaz, his father, had stripped the temple of gold and silver and paid off the Assyrian. When Hezekiah came to the throne, he rebelled against that and he would have none of it. He trusted in Yahweh. In fact, a summary of Hezekiah's reign is given in 2 Chronicles 31:20-21. And thus did Hezekiah throughout all Judah, and wrought that which was good and right and truth before Yahweh his God. And in everything he began in the service of the house of God and in the law and in the commandments to seek his God. He did it with all his heart and prospered. Very faithful king. So that's a brief background to Hezekiah the man as to what he did. Now, just giving you a little historical background to the events leading up to Isaiah 36. We notice there in verse 1 of Isaiah 36 that the incident recorded there came to pass in the 14th year of his reign. Well, what happened prior to this, prior to the 14th year? Well, when Hezekiah came to the throne, the northern kingdom still existed. But in the fourth year of Hezekiah's reign, Shalmaneser, who was king of Assyria at the time, he invaded Israel, he besieged their capital, Samaria, and in the sixth year, the city was taken by Sargon, the successor to Shalmaneser. So the northern kingdom, which had lasted for approximately 200 years, came to an end. It was finished. And all that was left now of the once great kingdom of God was the little nation of Judah in the south with Jerusalem as its capital. Now this is in Hezekiah's sixth year. Isaiah 36 tells us in verse 1 that those events took place in the 14th year. So it means that from the time Sargon sacked the city of Samaria until the Assyrians came back again, Hezekiah was spared and given another 8 years of peace. And he would have spent that time very profitably, brothers and sisters, in building up the nation. But inevitably, what Hezekiah thought would happen did happen. And so in Hezekiah's 14th year, the Assyrian returns with a vengeance. And there's no question this was a crisis, an absolute crisis for the nation. Now, why would we say that? Why was it a crisis? I mean, bearing in mind that they were the people of God. Well, although this section of scripture that we're looking at tonight and over the next few classes only occupies 3 or 4 chapters here, it really deals with just 1 year of Hezekiah's reign. All the events recorded here in Isaiah 36 through to 39, I think, took place, generally speaking, over a period of 1 year. But although it was just 1 year of Hezekiah's life, it was really most significant because it was a crisis of gigantic proportions. What was at stake? What was at stake here? The northern kingdom had already fallen. All that was left was just that southern kingdom in Judah. And what was at stake, brothers and sisters, was the survival of the city of Jerusalem. It was the last remaining stronghold, essentially, against the Assyrians, as we shall see. It was the last remaining stronghold. But more than that, at stake was the nation. At stake was the kingdom of Judah. At stake was the throne of David. Effectively, what was at stake here in Isaiah 36 was the kingdom of God. If Sennacherib was able to conquer, defeat Jerusalem, then the kingdom of God ceased to exist. That's how serious this crisis was in Isaiah 36. And we will find that it wasn't just a crisis for the city or the nation. It was a personal crisis as well for Hezekiah. Because in the midst of this crisis, in the midst of this very, very troubled times for the nation, Hezekiah himself was brought face to face with death. And we'll come across that later. When Hezekiah was told those dramatic words by Isaiah, "Set thine house in order, for thou shalt die." Now think about that. In the midst of all this, when it would appear as though the very kingdom of God was on its knees, Hezekiah himself is told to set his house in order and he shall die. But I hope that we will see when we consider these interesting chapters that there are valuable lessons for ourselves. And the scriptures, I think, certainly intend this period of time in Hezekiah's life to be one of great lessons for us, because I haven't actually counted up all the chapters in the Bible, but I have found at least 32 chapters in the Bible which deal with this time period. Now, we're only looking at 4 here, but there are at least 32 chapters in the Bible dealing with this 14th year of King Hezekiah. Now, not just in Isaiah, We find there are chapters in Kings, there are chapters in Chronicles, there are the chapters I've already referred to in Isaiah, there are the Songs of Degrees. All of these sections of the Bible deal with incidents involving King Hezekiah and his reign. So it was a very, very important section of Scripture. And if you were to put a caption over this time period, and probably a caption over Hezekiah's life generally, the caption would be "Trusting God in Troubled Times." Trusting God in Troubled Times. And one of the sections in Scripture tells us, I think it might be in the book of Kings, it tells us that Hezekiah was a man who did indeed that. He trusted Yahweh despite all the difficulties that came his way. And the same thing could apply to us. Trusting God in troubled times. One of the other things which comes out of a study of Hezekiah, brothers and sisters, is that despite his obvious great righteousness, nevertheless, these trials came upon him. I mean, we saw this evening in those overheads how zealous and dedicated Hezekiah was. He opened the temple in the first month of his reign. He reinstituted the Passover. He cleansed the land of all its idols. He encouraged those in the north to turn again to their God. He did everything possible to revitalize the people. And yet, despite all that, he had these tremendous trials and difficulties. And I think what it teaches us is that righteousness does not lessen trials. In fact, it may be the basis for increasing trials. And that's something which we sometimes may find hard to appreciate. That righteousness does not lessen trials. It may, in fact, be the basis for increasing them. Now, let me just put on the screen for you the increasing territory that the Assyrians collected over a period of time. Not too sure how this shows up on the screen. Oh, it's quite remarkably clear. Now, as the colour here in the map increases in its intensity, then that is indicative of the spread of the Assyrian dominion. You see, just there, right at the beginning, the lightest colour was the extent of the Assyrian territory about 1340 BC. And then gradually, it extended further and further and further. Now, you'll notice that line there, the demarcation between the two different colours of purple, is it? Or deep pink. But just above, or just below Samaria, you see the difference in colours, and that shows us how that Samaria, capital of the northern kingdom, finally fell, and then after that, Assyria moved further south and took the territory of Judah. So slowly but surely, you see, the Assyrian kingdom was getting bigger and bigger in its domain. And Hezekiah knew that, you see. When Shalmaneser came down and attacked the city of Samaria here in Hezekiah's fourth year, I mean, look at the distance between Jerusalem and Samaria. It's only a few miles, relatively speaking, isn't it? A few kilometres. Not very big distances at all. And Hezekiah would have known that sooner or later the Assyrian was going to come further south. I mean, over a period of years, they'd gone from there to there. Obviously, that would be next. And then eventually, of course, they came right down there. So Hezekiah knew that eventually the Assyrians would come down. In his sixth year, Sargon sacked the city of Samaria. Hezekiah, through the grace of God, was given another 8 years, and he used his time wisely to prepare the people. Now, all of this information, I believe, is important and necessary for us to capture the scene presented here in Isaiah 36 and verse 1. Some of this material you may have seen before, but it's important to consider it. What were the Assyrians like? I mean, if you were King Hezekiah in the city of Jerusalem, And you heard of the fall of Samaria in your sixth year, how would you react? What would you think about it? Would you think, well, I mean, they're not a very powerful army. I think with a bit of luck, we should be able to defeat them next time round. In a book entitled Vanished Civilizations, we have a commentary on the might of Assyria. In the 9th century, after a period of revolt and disarray, the Assyrians set out to establish an empire. Their army was the most formidable fighting machine of its day, hardened by years of rigorous campaigning, as we saw on that map, the territory getting bigger and bigger, organised into corps of swift-moving chariots, cavalry, bowmen and lancers. Their iron-headed battering rams could breach walls that hitherto had been thought impregnable. So you had these fortresses in Judea, very thick walls, and the men may have thought that previously no army could breach those walls, but the Assyrians came along and they had battering rams that could do that. Their soldiers were sustained by a fierce religious fervour, which is illustrated in their art by the figure of the god Assur, always hovering over them as they go into battle. Well, that describes the strength of their army. What were they like as men in the army? Well, they were very, very cruel. Very, very cruel people. The cruelty of the Assyrians. This is a record taken from one of the inscriptions left by an Assyrian king when he sacked a city. 3,000 of their combat troops I fell with weapons, many of the captives taken from them I burned in a fire, many I took alive. From some of these I cut off their hands to the wrist, from others I cut off their noses, ears and fingers, put out the eyes of many of the soldiers, I burnt their young men and women to death. I fixed up a pile of corpses in front of the city's gate, I flayed the nobles, as many as had rebelled, and spread their skins out on the piles. I flayed many within my land and spread their skins out on the walls. Now, the Assyrians were a very proud people, and to that extent, we are fortunate because of their pride in being able to have accurate records of what they did. Whenever an Assyrian king went on a large invasion of another country, and he came back to Nineveh, or whatever the capital may have been at the time, he would inscribe on stone his exploits so that posterity could read of all that they did. And because they were so proud, they were anxious to record all of their victories. In fact, although they must have occasionally have had a defeat, there is no defeat ever recorded inscribed in stone or clay or whatever of an Assyrian army. They never ever admitted defeat. I'd just like to read to you an extract from a book called Art and Empire. Earlier this year I was fortunate enough to be in Melbourne when there was an exhibition in the Melbourne National Gallery of the Art and Empire of Assyria. Now this was taken straight out of the British Museum, and Jeff Kennett, as he's so often known to do, made sure that Melbourne had this great exhibition. And they packed all these artefacts and great stone sculptures into containers and flew them out to Melbourne and put them up in the Melbourne National Gallery, and people could go there and look at them. And I was in Melbourne at the time, and I went and had a look, and I actually purchased a book there called Art and Empire. And it's a fascinating book because it has photographs and descriptions of all that was once the great, mighty Assyrian Empire. This is an extract from that concerning Assyrian victories. It says, "The one subject not carved on stone was representation of an Assyrian defeat. There are no Assyrian dead. One is reminded of the formula with which the king would close his official report to the god Assur." So when the king came back from a battle, he would write out a report to the god Assur as to how the battle went. After describing some long and bloody campaign, the king would admit that there had been just 6 Assyrian casualties. 1 charioteer died, 2 horsemen and 3 foot soldiers. Now, can you imagine that? A huge army going out to fight another army. The battle wages for hours, days, whatever, weeks. The Assyrians finally conquer the city. They go back to Nineveh, and the king inscribes in stone the record of the battle. And he says, "O God Assur, here is my faithful report. A long, arduous battle. We did lose a few. I must admit, we lost 1 charioteer, 2 horsemen and 3 foot soldiers." Now that's the extent of their admission that they had lost something. They never ever wanted to admit defeats. It mentions in that other article taken from the Might of Assyria about the Assyrian battering rams. Now, that probably is not that clear, but that is actually a photograph taken from a description of a battle inscribed in stone, which is in the British Museum, but it was actually flown out to Melbourne, and I actually saw this literally in the Melbourne National Gallery. There you have the battering ram, and it's got the battering rams there being pushed against the wall. You have the Assyrian archers here. And to scare the inhabitants of the city who were refusing to submit, those that were captured were impaled. Now see how they're impaled there? They used to ram their bodies on an upright pole, and the pole would go up through here and probably come out through their chin or whatever. They used to impale them on poles, and they would stick these people all around the walls of the city and frighten the inhabitants into submission. Even if you submitted, the chances are you would suffer this anyway. So it was a frightening time for anyone that was being attacked by an Assyrian army. And we read before, didn't we, how that some of them that they captured, they would actually flay them alive. They would get knives and cut off the first layer of skin and take it off and flay them. And of course, the shock to the system would eventually kill the person. They were very, very cruel people. In fact, they were known as the Nazis of old times. This was the nation. Sennacherib was in charge of this great army that invaded Judah in the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign. Now, as to Sennacherib himself, the historian Rawlinson wrote of him. He's the man recorded there in Isaiah 36 and verse 1. The historian Rawlinson said of Sennacherib, "He was a worthy successor of his father Sargon and of the second Tiglath-Pileser, active in his military enterprises, indefatigable, persevering, full of resource. No more energetic soldier ever found himself at the head of a huge army eager for battle. No more vigorous..." Ralph had me shocked there for a moment because I thought he was going to stand up and say something. "No more energetic soldier ever found himself at the head of a huge army eager for battle. No more vigorous administrator ever commanded the resource of a vast empire." And in the general commentary on that, "Born and bred a crown prince, his primary characteristic was an overwhelming pride which shows itself in all his inscriptions." Now, when you think of all that, who was going to stop? Who was going to stop the army of Sennacherib when he invaded Judah in the 36th year? So let's turn then, in his 14th year, in Isaiah 36. Let's turn to Isaiah 36 and have a look at this. Now, we're not going to get very far tonight because I wanted to lay the groundwork for future nights and just show you paint the scene of what's happening. Verse 1. "Now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defenced cities of Judah and took them." And we're going to see in a moment how even Sennacherib recorded this. But just here on the map, when Sennacherib came up and took all the fenced cities of Judah, the only two fortresses effectively that were left were Lachish and Jerusalem. They were the only two fortresses of note that were left after Sennacherib invaded the kingdom of Judah. Sennacherib was very proud of what he had achieved, and like many of his exploits, he recorded these in stone. And so again, in the museum, there is the what is known as Taylor's Prism. And this is a translation of what was actually recorded on this prism by Sennacherib. And this is really an account of what we've just read in Isaiah 36, verse 1. As for Hezekiah, the Judean who did not submit to my yoke, I surrounded and conquered 46 of his strong walled towns and innumerable small settlements around them by means of earth ramps and siege engines, and attacked by infantry men, mining, breaking through and scaling. I brought out from them and counted in spoil 200,150 people of all ranks, men and women, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, cattle and sheep. He himself I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him with watchposts and made it impossible for anyone to go in or out of his city. His cities, which I had despoiled, I cut off, etc. Now, we won't read all of that. I'm just going to come back to that in a moment. Just go back to Isaiah chapter 8 for a moment. And you'll see this is one of the prophecies in Isaiah, which we looked at quite some time ago, 2 or 3 years ago, obviously, where the prophet Isaiah predicted how that the Assyrians would come down and they would reach even unto the neck. And I find that as a reference to the city of Jerusalem. Because of the continued wickedness of God's people, we read in verse 7, "Now therefore, behold, Yahweh bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks." And so as we saw on that map, the territory of Assyria got bigger and bigger and bigger as the years went by. "And he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck." Now the neck, I see, is a reference to the city of Jerusalem. Just like waters are coming up, and as the waters rise, so people who are in that precarious position know that if the waters get too high, of course they will drown. Once the waters go above the neck, what's next? It's the nose, your mouth, and that's it. You're no longer able to breathe. So the prophet is describing the precarious position that the nation of Judah would get itself into. The waters of Assyria would get higher and higher and higher, reach even unto the neck, and it would appear as though the nation was almost going to be snuffed out. But you'll notice that the prophet does not say that the waters go any higher. They will reach to the neck, certainly, but they wouldn't go any higher. And here we have on this prism here a record of how Sennacherib comes down, he conquers all the defence cities of Judah, until at last only Lachish and Jerusalem are left. Now let's go back then to Isaiah chapter 36. And when you read verse 2, the natural assumption, brethren, sisters and young people, is to take that as being the very next event, as though what happened in verse 2 was straight away after verse 1. Now, I don't believe that's the case. In fact, I think when we turn to the historical records in the Bible, we can show that that was not the case. There was certainly a time gap between verse 1 and verse 2. Verse 1 is clear. Sennacherib comes up and he takes the fortress cities of Judah, and his prism records that. Then it tells us the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish. So he's conquered all the fortresses. He's now down at Lachish, and he's laying siege with battering rams and whatever. He's laying siege against Lachish. And whilst he's at Lachish, he sends ambassadors from Lachish up to Jerusalem with a demand that they surrender. Now that's essentially the message of Isaiah 36. But did verse 2 take place immediately after verse 1? Now, I don't think it did. Let's turn to 2 Kings chapter 18. Now, because we are essentially studying the book of Isaiah, we haven't got time, of course, to go into all the intricate background to the circumstances of the day. But let me just briefly paint the picture for you. It seems to me pretty obvious that whilst Sennacherib was laying siege to Lachish, that Hezekiah came under considerable pressure from people in the city, that is in Jerusalem, to do something about their precarious position. I mean, what was he going to do? The Sennacherib and his army were on the march, weren't they? All the fortresses had fallen. What was he going to do? Now, as far as Hezekiah was concerned, I don't think there's any doubt that he was prepared to put his trust in his God. But he came under tremendous pressure, brothers and sisters, to do something about their precarious position. And unfortunately, there were a group in the city who were anxious to form alliances with foreign powers. Now, we'll just briefly look at this for a moment, but let me just show you the historical record. 2 Kings 18, verse 13. Here we have the same facts presented in Isaiah 36, verse 1. Now, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. So that corresponds with Isaiah 36, verse 1, doesn't it? Is that clear? If it's not, sing out. Clear so far? So verse 13 corresponds with Isaiah 36, verse 1. But what happens after those cities are taken? Isaiah doesn't tell us this, but the king's record tells us that Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, "I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear." And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. Now, isn't that interesting? You see, here we are told something which Isaiah doesn't tell us. Isaiah goes straight from verse 1 into verse 2, whereas the king's record tells us that what happened between Isaiah 36, verse 1 and 2 is what is recorded in verses 14 to 16 of 2 Kings 18. Those verses 14 to 16 are what took place between those two verses in Isaiah. Very, very important facts, because it shows us that Hezekiah, for whatever reason, made the mistake of his father. You remember when Ahaz reigned, he stripped the temple of gold and silver and paid tribute money to the Assyrians. Now, when Hezekiah came to the throne, he would have thought to himself, "I'm not going to make the same mistakes as my father. I will have trust in Yahweh." And yet, when the crunch came, what did Hezekiah do? He did exactly the same thing. He said to Sennacherib, "I have offended. Whatever you impose upon me, I will pay." So, what did Sennacherib do? Well, here it is here in the prism. Now, there are some slight differences in the tribute money levied against Hezekiah. We'll take the Bible as being more accurate, but nevertheless, Sennacherib does tell us what he did. "He had brought after me to Nineveh, my royal city, 30 talents of gold, 800 talents of silver." The king's record tells us 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So Sennacherib does record on stone that Hezekiah paid this tribute money over. Now, why would he do that? Well, Hezekiah himself could have fallen in a temporary lapse of weakness. That's quite conceivable, isn't it? In a temporary moment of weakness, despite all his faith, He nevertheless caved in at a time of great trial. And it would appear that that is the case. But quite apart from that, brothers and sisters, I don't think there's any doubt that Hezekiah came under a lot of pressure in the city. Now, Brian has looked at this in previous classes, but let's just turn over for a moment to Isaiah 30 and 31. And here we have Isaiah telling us what the heart of the people was like at the time of this invasion. Let's read, say, verses 1 and 2. "Woe to the rebellious children, saith Yahweh, that take counsel, but not of me, and that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, that walk to go down into Egypt, and have not asked at my mouth, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt your confusion." And you may recall when we looked at this chapter earlier this year, I think it was, where Brian painted the picture of the inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem loading up the asses with all the riches and the money and charging off down through the Negev, through the desert, down into Egypt, there to meet the ambassadors of Egypt, to come to an agreement whereby the Egyptians would help the inhabitants of Judah or the inhabitants of Jerusalem at this time of great peril. Sennacherib is in the land of Judah. He's taking one fortress after another. What were the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do? Well, there were some in the city that said to Hezekiah, "There's only one way we can get out of this. We've got to hot foot it down to Egypt and form a pact with the Egyptians, and they will save us." And so Isaiah 30 tells us of the stupidity of these people who loaded up the asses and beasts in verse 6, loaded them up with riches, and went down into Egypt there to try and buy assistance. And yet the condemnation from Isaiah in verse 7 was, "The Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. They would be useless when the crunch came." And while we're in Isaiah, in chapter 31, we have the same picture presented. "Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay on horses, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Yahweh." And Isaiah reprimands them for not even giving their God a thought. And in satire, Isaiah says to them in verse 2, "Haven't you ever stopped to think that your God has wisdom? Why go down to Egypt? Have you ever stopped to think that you could give your God a thought? He may be able to get you out of your trouble." But they wouldn't have it, you see. Now, those influences were in the city. Very much so. They definitely had sent their ambassadors down to Egypt. Hezekiah is being pressured from all sides to do something about their precarious position. And I think in a moment of weakness, he gave in. He bought time. He said to the Assyrians, "Look, whatever you want, I will give it to you." They said, "Righto, here's the tribute." Now, how is he going to get it? And rather foolishly, he stripped the temple of its silver and gold and handed it over to Sennacherib. Now, would you ever think that Hezekiah would do that, like his father? But he did it. And I think what that teaches us, brethren and sisters, is a very important lesson in life, and that is this, that as we have it in the scriptures, "He that thinketh he standeth, take heed lest he fall." It is so easy for us to stand up in a righteous position and look at the fall of someone who has fallen to sin, and say, "I would never do that. Never ever would I do that." And we must be very careful in the way we look at others who may fall, because there may come a time when we will be placed under pressure, and to our dismay, we may find that we also shall do foolish things. Sin is wrong, of course, and what Hezekiah did was wrong.
But the scriptures tell us that it is Yahweh in whom we should place our trust, and not to think we are better than our brethren because they have fallen, as we had it in our Galatians class only recently. Bear ye one another's burdens, because there may be a time when we will need someone to help us in our burden. You remember Peter, when the Lord said that he was to die, and Peter said, "They'll all forsake you, I won't." "Is that so?" said Christ. "I tell you, Peter, this night, before the cock crows, you shall deny me three times." And it happened. But Peter would never ever have thought that that would happen. But it did happen. And Hezekiah perhaps never thought that he would go down the same track as his father. But he did. And it's a very timely reminder for us as to what our position should be in the sight of our God. Well now, no sooner had Hezekiah paid over that tribute money than I think he realised his mistake. I think he saw that it was the most stupidest thing he could ever do, was to try and parley with the world. As if you can save yourself from your problems by coming to a deal with the world. And the same principle could apply to us. As if we, brethren and sisters, can think that somehow we can get through life's problems by somehow making an arrangement with the world. As if the world can help us when we are in difficult times. The world won't help us. It's the scriptures, it's the word of God, it's prayer, it's our Father that will help us. And fortunately, I believe that Hezekiah saw that. And no sooner had he paid over the tribute money, but he decided to rebel. And he got the people together and he said, "Look, there's only one way we're going to succeed in this time of crisis, and that is, by all means, we will build up the defences of the city." There's no question that he did that. But the more important thing was that he encouraged them to put their trust in Yahweh. Now, if we turn over to 2 Chronicles 32, we'll see this was exactly what Hezekiah did. He encouraged the people in the things that were right. See, verse 1 of 2 Chronicles 32 tells us once again about the invasion by Sennacherib. I think between verses 1 and 2, Hezekiah had paid his tribute money. But when he realised his mistake and when he saw that Sennacherib was definitely going to come back, you'd never be able to buy off Sennacherib forever, he decided to do something about the state of the city, to build up its resources. But at the same time, he did something about encouraging the people. We find in verse 5 that he strengthened himself spiritually. He built up the wall that was broken, raised it up to the towers, and another wall without, and repaired Millo in the city of David, and made darts and shields in abundance. And he set captains of war over the people and gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city. So in the principal meeting place of the city, they all gathered together. And there we find that he spake comfortably to them. The word has a sense of speaking tenderly. He appealed to them to recognise from whence their strength came. And in those lovely words there of verse 7, "Be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him, for there be more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles." And the people rested or leaned themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Now, just have a look at verse 7 there for a moment. Just keep your finger in there. Go over to Isaiah chapter 36. I think it's in Isaiah 36. It might be in the King's record. Isaiah 36 and verse 2. Now, we're now looking at the time period after Hezekiah has realised his mistake. "And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army." Does anyone know how many was in the army? Right. 185,000. So Sennacherib has sent from Lachish 185,000 men, surrounds the city of Jerusalem. Now, before they arrived, and Hezekiah would have known how big the army of Sennacherib was, he knew that. He would have had his spies out. He knew how many were throughout the land. You go back to 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 7. He's got all the people standing in the market square. And he says to them, in verse 7, "Be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the 185,000 that is with him, for there be more with us than with him." And as he's saying those words, the people are looking around and... I think I can see 1,000 or so of our men. I don't know where the rest are. Yeah. What's Hezekiah talking about? They can see 1,000 or so men there ready for battle in the city of Jerusalem. It wasn't a big city, brethren and sisters. It wasn't a huge metropolis like Sydney. It was just a tiny little town, really, in today's standards. How many can you cram into that city? How many fighting men can you cram into that city? There's 185,000 Assyrians, and he says to the people, there's more with us than with them. And it took a tremendous amount of faith for them to believe that. What he's referring to, of course, was not men of war. He was referring to the angels of God. And it's interesting, you may like to just follow this through, but that you'll notice in your margin, that statement of Hezekiah's in verse 7 is taken from 2 Kings 6:16. And they are the words of Elisha. When Elisha was in a city surrounded by the Syrians, and the servant of Elisha was concerned about it, and Elisha said to his servant, "Don't worry, there's more with us than with them." And suddenly the servant's eyes were opened, and surrounding Elisha, surrounding the city, were all these myriads of angels. And so Hezekiah knew his scriptures, and he knew that although they couldn't literally see the angels, they were there. And there were certainly more than 185,000 men. So he was confident that they would be able to defeat the Assyrians. Now, just going back to 2 Chronicles, oh, we're already there, no need to go back up. In 2 Chronicles 32, in verse 4, it says, amongst other things, or verse 3, "He took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city, and they did help them." What they did was they covered up the spring Gihon and constructed an aqueduct underground which led to a pool inside the walls of the city, so that when the Assyrians came to attack the city, there was no water available to the Assyrians, but there was plenty of water for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, because the spring Gihon bubbled forth and the water ran into this aqueduct underground and came out inside the walls of the city into a pool. Let me just put on the screen here an artist's impression of the city of Jerusalem as it was in the days of Hezekiah. Well, not exactly in the days of Hezekiah, I should say in the days of Solomon. Now, in the days of Hezekiah, this hill here, the western hill, was also inhabited. And so the wall would have gone around, further around this western hill. And that valley in between the two hills is the Tyropean Valley, which if you went to Jerusalem today, I understand, it basically doesn't exist, because over centuries, rubble was thrown into that valley, and so the level was raised, so that the valley essentially does not exist today. But that's an artist's impression of what the city of Jerusalem was like in the days of Solomon, and certainly in the days of Hezekiah, but with this extension around here. Now, the spring Gihon was just in there, just there. Now, normally, men and women would go outside the walls of the city in, when there was no siege, and they would be able to collect water from that spring and take it back inside the city. Incidentally, you can see that, like, it's not a very big city there, is it? And even if you extended it over this western hill, it wasn't a large town by any stretch of imagination. Now, what Hezekiah did was, he and his men constructed this aqueduct, which they covered up this spring here so that it wasn't visible to anyone, and then the water from the spring ran into an aqueduct carved into the limestone underneath the city walls, and it was a remarkable engineering feat. It was sort of like an S-shaped tunnel, which eventually came out around here somewhere into what was later known as the Pool of Siloam. Here on this other transparency, we have this indicated for you. That was actually, that map which I just showed you, that was that territory there, the original city of Solomon. And then later on in Hezekiah's day, the western hill was also enclosed by a wall, and there's the Tyropean Valley there. Well, there's the Gihon Spring, and Hezekiah and his men built this S-shaped aqueduct underground, which eventually led to the Siloam Pool. And that is what is meant there in 2 Chronicles 32 in verses 3 and 4. They stopped the spring Gihon and they constructed this aqueduct. And so water was saved. Now, this has got nothing to do with the study as such tonight, but this is a fascinating thing. I found it when I was poring over this map. Before the aqueduct was built, interestingly enough, when the water came out of the spring Gihon, it actually did run through a channel that they had built or constructed inside rock, which ran all the way down here and eventually ended up in that pool there. But at regular intervals in this channel, they dug little holes into the rock from which water would run out, see that there, and irrigate these vegetable gardens. And when archaeologists recently, when I say recently, in the last few years of course, went to Jerusalem, they actually found evidence of these little holes. That's actually part of the conduit that was built that ran from the spring Gihon and went down, of course, to the pool. And there was one of the little holes, there's a man standing in it, from which the water would, they obviously had plugs in it, they could plug that or take the plug out, and the water would run out and irrigate the vegetable gardens. Window-like apertures, such as this one discovered in the eastern wall of the Siloam Channel, were part of an ingenious irrigation system. Other apertures were cut on the western side of the channel to catch rain flowing down the slope of the hill. And the Siloam Channel also provided a conduit for water from the Gihon Spring to reservoirs at the southern end of the city of David. Now, it's most interesting stuff, isn't it? It shows you that the men back in Hezekiah's day were, you know, fools. You know, they were men of some note, and they knew what they were doing, and they were prepared to prepare the water supply. Now, and just finally, here's a modern day picture, so to speak, of the aqueduct. That's a picture of inside the aqueduct that Hezekiah and his men constructed under the city through the limestone. The water would rush from the spring Gihon into that, and eventually it came out here into the Pool of Siloam. There's a lot of references to the Pool of Siloam in scriptures, even in the Gospel of John, you may recall. Now let's go back to Isaiah 36. Bearing all this in mind, brothers and sisters, the stage is now set for the showdown. Hezekiah has realised his mistake. He's prepared the people to face the foe. No longer is he interested in listening to the influences of those who wanted to go down to Egypt. As far as he is concerned, there's only one way they can survive, and that is through trust in Yahweh. So the king of Assyria sends from Lachish, Rabshakeh, with a great army, 185,000 men. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. So as I see it, when Rabshakeh and his men turned up, they were standing somewhere around about here. Somewhere around about here, Rabshakeh stood with his associates. The people there, now you may not believe this, but this happened. The people actually were leaning over the wall, listening to what was being said. This comes out on the record. They were there leaning over the wall, hearing what Rabshakeh had to say. Now, Rabshakeh is standing there from a position of strength. I mean, they may not have been literally behind him. They may have been over the next hill or so. But effectively, behind Rabshakeh were 185,000 men. And hold up here in the city of David is just relatively few. So Rabshakeh stands up, and he's got strength on his side. Now, what does Hezekiah do? He doesn't come out personally. We read in verse 3, "Then came forth unto him Eliakim, Hilkiah's son, which was over the house, and Shebna the scribe, and Joah, Asaph's son, the recorder." Now, can anyone remember when we looked at Isaiah 22, what was Shebna's role back in those days? If you turn to Isaiah 22, you'll find that Shebna was given a description as to a particular role that he had. And can we notice something different here in verse 3? Incidentally, Isaiah 22 is also dealing with the time period of Hezekiah, because it's talking about them doing something about their water supply in verse 9. But Isaiah utters this very strong words of condemnation against this man Shebna in verse 15. Now, can anyone notice the difference between Shebna's role in verse 15 of Isaiah 22 and now in Isaiah 36? That's right. You see, in verse 15 of Isaiah 22, when Isaiah spoke against Shebna, which would have been dealt with earlier in Isaiah class, Shebna is described there as being over the house. He was the Secretary of State, I suppose you'd call him. He had a very, very important role in the city. He was the king's right-hand man. He dealt with important matters of state. But Isaiah condemned Shebna because he was a man that was not a man of faith. Shebna was a man who was more interested in building up his own position in the city rather than trusting in his God. And he was so convinced that everything would be all right in the city, despite the Assyrian invasion, that he made elaborate plans to build this very, very ornate, decorative, tomb for himself. He didn't want just an ordinary coffin or just an ordinary cave with a stone rolled in front of it. He had this elaborate tomb built for himself so that when he died, everyone would say, "Oh, that's where Shebna was buried." He was so convinced that the city would never fall to the Assyrians. But he was a Judaistic man, you see. He was a man that put a lot of pride in flesh. He wasn't a man that put faith in his God. And because of that, Isaiah condemned him and said to him in verse 15, "Against this man of the house, behold," verse 17, "Yahweh will carry thee away with a mighty captivity and will surely cover thee. He will surely violently turn and toss thee like a ball into a large country. There shalt thou die, and there the chariots of thy glory shall be the shame of thy Lord's house. And I will drive thee from thy station, and from thy state shall he pull thee down." So instead of Shebna staying in the city secure, Isaiah says to him, "You're going to be tossed out of the city like a ball, and you'll roll and roll and roll, and you'll just disappear into oblivion." Well, when we come to Isaiah 36, he's still got an important role, there's no question of that. He's there negotiating with the Assyrians, but you see, he's no longer over the house. He's been deposed. And the other person mentioned in Isaiah 22, Eliakim, now is over the house. You see, the roles have been changed. Eliakim has been elevated, and Eliakim is unquestionably a type of the Lord Jesus Christ, and Shebna has been deposed. He's now just described as the scribe. Now, Rabshakeh, standing there outside the walls of Jerusalem, standing there, says to these three men, Eliakim, Shebna and Joah, "Say ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria," as if to say, well, that title alone should force you to submit. "Thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria," as if to say, what more needs to be said? Think about our record. Where have we come from? Whom have we conquered? Who is next on our list? How can you withstand our might? And mockingly says to the three representatives of Hezekiah, who are you putting your trust in? What confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Now, how would you like to be those three men there, standing there in the vegetable garden, listening to Rabshakeh, knowing that behind him is 185,000 men, knowing that in the city are not many, and also knowing that in the city are even influences that if they had their way would have brought in the Egyptians to help. Hezekiah has gathered them all into the market square and he said to them, now look, our only hope of salvation is to put trust in Yahweh. We've got no other way of escaping this. And there they are standing in the vegetable garden facing the onslaught from Rabshakeh. And he sneeringly says at them, who are you putting your trust in? Where's your strength? He says, I say, that's that verse 4, Rabshakeh said unto them, say ye now to Hezekiah, who hasn't even bothered to turn up, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? I say, sayest thou, but they are but vain words, I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? You see, they had found out about what Hezekiah was up to. He had previously stripped the temple of the silver and gold and paid over the tribute money. Then he decides to rebel. And so Sennacherib through Rabshakeh says, who do you think you are that you can dare to rebel against me, the great king, the king of Assyria? And you think you've got allies, says Rabshakeh. Verse 6, lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt. See, Rabshakeh knew about that. He knew about the influences in the city, which we looked at in Isaiah 30 and 31, which decided to go down to Egypt and there to enlist their help by paying over their riches. Rabshakeh knew about it. And he says to them mockingly, you're going to put your trust in Egypt. What sort of help are they? They're like a broken reed, which, if a man leans upon it, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. So they're mocking the attempts to buy help from Egypt. Now, Rabshakeh, of course, did not know that that factor in the city was only from a minority, as I see it. Hezekiah certainly wasn't wanting to do that, was he? Hezekiah had his trust in God. It was only a certain element in the city that wanted to go down to Egypt. Rabshakeh didn't know that. Well, even if he did, he's playing upon it and saying to them, you've got no hope of withstanding the mighty army of Sennacherib. There's an interesting play upon words here. Notice in verse 6, lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed on Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. But just quickly go back to 2 Chronicles 32. You see, whilst they may have at one stage leant on Egypt, that was no more. You remember when Hezekiah gathered them in the market square and spoke to them and said to them, be strong and courageous, for there are more with us than with them. Verse 8, with him is an arm of flesh, but with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people leaned in the margin, leaned themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Now, brethren and sisters, that was a factor which Hezekiah, which Rabshakeh didn't know. You see, as far as Rabshakeh was concerned, he thought they were still making these alliances with Egypt. And he says, why do you want to lean upon Egypt? He's like a broken reed. You no sooner lean upon him than the whole thing will just collapse and you've got no support whatsoever. Little did Rabshakeh know that Hezekiah only a short time before had got them together, encouraged them, and the record specifically tells us that they leaned themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. So whilst Rabshakeh is mocking them and saying, why are you leaning upon Egypt? Little did he know that the people looking over the walls and listening to what's being said were already convinced that they had to lean themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, and as a consequence, of course, lean upon Yahweh, their God. Now that is where we'll leave it tonight. As I said, we didn't get very far, but that was not by accident, it was by design, because it's important, I think, to lay the groundwork, because we can then appreciate the drama that then develops in these next few chapters.